Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Brenor.
And our other team member, Devinder Hardwar, is away on assignment, as they say. But he'll be joining us hopefully next week at the same time and same location. But until then, this week on the show, we're going to look into a scandal involving Scott Thompson, Yahoo's CEO, that's being alternatively called ResumeGate or CS Lie. Later, we'll poke into a couple of exciting Apple rumors. But first, let's talk about what we're playing with this week. Dwayne, I'll let you kick this one off.
Sure. I have two things I'm playing with. One is IVI. Mm-hmm. It's a great utility on the Mac App Store. I think it's $4, $3.99 or something like that. And what it allows you to do is put any file. You know, like I ripped my DVD collection at Xvid a little while ago. Mm-hmm. I made the wrong move when it came to like codecs, and IVI allows me to basically dump them into a folder, and for $4, I don't have to think about getting on Handbrake and queuing anything up. It's on my Mac. It understands that I have an Apple TV 3, and it just takes everything I have and it makes it work for that device. It checks the folder from time to time. Uh-huh. Automatically throws things in a queue. And it re-encodes them. If it's already in H.264, because I have a couple files that way, it will just pass it through, turn it into an MKV, an M4V.
Nice.
That M4V will automatically be imported into iTunes. And if I'm on my Apple TV, I mean, it's almost real time that I see the stuff updated. So it's a pretty powerful program. I've run into a couple problems with it. Not problems, apparently, that many people see. It's a small, you know, Apple, small independent developer for OS X. So I've reached out to them. And David over at South Pole Software that makes IVI, he's been looking into every possible thing. You know, when the Mac crashes, it's got the log information. Chuck it in the email, say, hey, David, this is the problem I'm having. You know, I noticed that it was crashing here, there, everywhere. Not everywhere, sorry. But he's like, hey, it could be Growl, it could be this, it could be that. And they've been working, and it's been, telling me what I need to do to make it more stable, and also telling me what they're going to do in their next release based on this kind of feedback. So, I had certain issues. I was running in an older hardware, things like that, but it's a great program to get your collection moved over into H.264, automatically input it into iTunes. I mean, it looks up your metadata is the really powerful thing. It goes out, and you can tell it where to look. It'll go out, it'll look up your metadata. It will put that metadata in there, you know, and in the real tags. It's not just assigning it to some, you know, random part, some random file that they have. So it doesn't matter where you move the file to, iTunes will understand it and whatever. And then you can import it into iTunes, and it's there. And then it takes the original file and it puts it wherever you want it to be put. I have a little folder called Purgatory, and it's just a great, great, you know, tool. I've also been playing with iCloud backup. I had this weird issue where my phone wasn't recognized. I'd walk in the house, my Mac would scream and say, I don't recognize your iPhone. I'd be like, what's the problem? I'd plug it in. I don't recognize your iPhone. Restore it. So I was a little trepidatious, but I restored it last night after calling up Apple and just double-checking that the iCloud backups were good. Apple actually told me that the iCloud backups would only put the applications back on, but I did it. I kept it plugged into the machine, and overnight I woke up and my phone was exactly as I left it without the music on it, of course. And it's been behaving really well ever since. So, you know, kudos to that iCloud backup thing. Works.
Cool.
I'll tell you what I'm not playing with this week, first of all. What I'm not playing with this week is my front projector, because the bulb blew out. I've had it installed since 2009, and I guess I've hit my 4,000 hours or whatever, because the bulb just, I was watching Game of Thrones the other night, and halfway through I hear this loud pop, pop out of the projector, and the screen went black. So
I like your Don Draper's take on that one. Like, this device is our failed dreams, our dreams that we want to
make. Yes. So I'm kind of dead in the water until I can get a new bulb for that.
Those things aren't cheap either, are they?
Well, the bulb for the projector that I had used to be a $500 list, and now I think it's down to just under $100, so it's not too bad.
Wow, that is a serious decline.
Yeah, yeah.
Go LED.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but I'm sure it does. Well, the other thing I've been playing with within the last week, Dwayne, you turned me on to Plex, and which is basically like a media server for your iPad. And I've had a lot of fun with Plex, although I've had a couple of issues. It works perfectly over my Wi-Fi network. In other words, over my local Wi-Fi network, I can stream out anything that comes from my home media server out to my iPad and watch anything out of there. And it works perfectly with all forms of media, audio and video, movies and television. What I'm having trouble with is I know that it can do this, but I'm having trouble doing it, is connecting when I'm not on my local Wi-Fi, connecting via...
the WAN.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the other thing I'm having trouble with is it seems to me like if I have a... if I've cloned a DVD, like if I've burned a DVD as a clone, it will only play like the first VOB file within that DVD. It won't play the whole DVD for some reason. I don't know why.
That's definitely interesting. Yeah, we'll talk about your version number and stuff right after the show, and we'll figure that puppy out. Plex to me is awesome because I have a humongous iTunes library, and when I try to load that thing via the videos app on my iPod or on my iPhone or iPad, it the videos app literally crashes when it requests the data from the from Apple. It'll get halfway. When it gets a little circle that goes around, and then it won't crash. That's the wrong thing. It'll then say there are no videos to be played. That's what it'll say. If I turn the Plex server on my Mac and I access that, it makes that Pi circle that happens in about a fourth of a second, and I have access to all the data, all the shows that I put on there, all the TV shows and movies and stuff like that. So it's very robust as compared to the Apple interface. And then anything that has to do with subtitles or whatever, that works really well. And then its transcoding engine must be amazing, because I used to have stuff on there that was like in XVID, and it would just play it. It would just send it to my iPad totally fine, no weird dithering, no anything, and it would just play it. So, I mean, it's very, like, as an out-of-the-box solution, once you learn a couple of its rules, like how to name stuff and things like that, you're actually in quite good shape. The only thing it doesn't do, of course, is what's it called? It doesn't do – you can't put the file directly onto your iOS device the way you could with iTunes or whatever. But with the WAN streaming, as long as you have connectivity, it doesn't really matter. Although, of course, that's subject to your connectivity. So if you got the 4G,
you don't really
iPad,
want another device anyway, right? You want it on a device that has tons of storage and just use the iPad as a control panel.
I think with the LTE iPad, Plex, like I could get a 32 gigabyte LTE iPad and be very happy with just access to the movies, because you can tell Plex to push out the stuff from your server at your total like household bandwidth, so it'll push it out at ridiculous your upload will just be like taken by Plex if you wanted to, and you can suck it down as fast as you can get it, and it looks pretty good. It's like having your own personal Netflix. So we'll talk at the end of the show, Andy, and we'll get you all set up.
Cool. One more thing I wanted to mention that I've been starting to play with, and actually I'm looking in our chat room. We got Dave from Geeks of Doom in there, and he's kicking me off mentioning this as well, is that Portal 2 is available on the Steam network now for $6, which is an incredible deal for possibly one of the best games of last year. And anyone who has not played Portal 2, even if you've never played the first Portal, you need to pick this up because it's completely worth it. And secondly, the other thing that I wanted to mention is that Portal has started a downloadable content called the Perpetual Testing Initiative. And what that is, it's a combination of easy-to-use puzzle creator, so players can create their own Portal 2 test chambers, and a level distribution platform, which is the Steam Workshop, so players can solve, rate, and comment on other people's test chambers. That just started within the last couple of days. I think that I've just started testing out other people's sample levels. Haven't really got into it, but it's totally worth it, and everyone should check it out. Have you guys seen this or tried this at all?
I've only played Portal 2 a little bit. I haven't seen this new stuff.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. It actually might get me back into Steam. Because I haven't been there in a while. But I think like the user made content, like Portal was such a awesome game, but it was unfortunate that it was so short, and I just would love to see what the rest of the community can come up with.
Absolutely. I mean, there's some really inventive people out there, and this reminds me a little bit of one of my favorite gaming experiences, which is the user-created content on Little Big Planet, if any of you have ever played that for the PS3.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there is literally just an endless supply of terrific user-generated content for that game, and it's all fairly a lot of fun. Let's move into some of our headlines here. First, right off the bat, Facebook has pulled the curtain on how much it thinks it's worth, targeting a valuation as rich as $96 billion in what would be a record debut for an American company. At nearly $100 billion, it would also rival the current market values of more established companies, including Amazon and McDonald's, and longtime tech giants like Hewlett-Packard, despite having a fraction of the revenue or profit. Currently, the largest valuation for a U.S. company at the time of an IPO was UPS in 1999 at $60.2 billion. So this definitely tops that. What do you think? Is this outrageous, or does this seem justified, $96 billion?
We are in a bubble.
you really taking this as a sign of a bubble?
The market is designed on the principle of confidence. I'm confident that Facebook will give value to its 900 million users, you know, a lot. Am I confident that it's worth that it's not just Facebook by itself, but you look at certain things like this kind of idea of buy high, sell higher kind of thing. We've seen just across the landscape between, you know, Facebook, Instagram, what's called Groupon tried to do. I feel like it's not sustainable. People say that about Apple all the time, but Apple makes real products. So I feel like kind of a bubble. I get why the conventional market thinks Facebook is, you know, the bee's knees. I do not think Facebook is the bee's knees. I just think that their valuations are based on a different kind of product and a different kind of service.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like we remain in this strange limbo. Now, the economy is already shite, right? So it's not like Facebook is holding the retirement stocks of a whole bunch of people. So if it goes down, I'm not seeing like – we're not going to like see like a whole bunch of like, oh, you know, there's no job necessarily or whatever. But I think in terms of like tech, there is a bit of – just unprecedented growth, so it makes me worried that we're in a bubble. I'll put it that way. It's not that we're in a bubble. I'm worried that we're in a bubble because it's unprecedented growth, and it's a traditional market looking at a product that is as far from traditional as you can get. Yeah. That market, which is more than 100 years old, was designed to assess the value.
Yeah. It is trading really high. I mean, like you compare it to like LinkedIn. So LinkedIn's market cap right now is about $12 billion. And they have about 160 million users, which puts them at about $70 per user. Facebook's valuation at that market cap values each of their users at like $160 per user, which just seems ridiculous for you know, a per user. I mean, are they really going to get $160 per user? It just seems crazy to think that they can make that.
Maybe
much.
Like lifetime value, with lifetime value being 5 years, you might get that out of it. But they really got to push those Facebook credits. Yeah.
I mean, it's really hard to say this because, I mean, like, yes, this is a giant valuation, the likes of which we haven't seen. On the other hand, Facebook is a big in the way that the internet has never seen before. I mean, forget Facebook all those pets.com or whatever. I mean,
yeah.
Pets.com.
I mean, like, they have users, and they're – I mean, it is – I think it's fair to say that they're really only beginning to unpack the value of those users in terms of advertising and monetization or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's hard to make the argument that they shouldn't be big. At the same time, I mean, Facebook is something that really is sort of unprecedented in the tech world, even compared to previous bubbles.
In the world, I think. I think not just in the world. In the world, 900 million people that are associated with one particular product. I feel like aside from oil, you know, what is out there that 900 million people use? And even with oil, it's not the same company.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. I mean, this is like this. I mean, they are sort of the internet equivalent of oil. Like, you just simply. I mean, there are people who get by on the internet without it, but it's pretty amazing to think, you know, that they have that. I don't know. It's one of those things where it just sort of is, and hopefully within like 6 months or so, the market will actually sort out what its actual value is once they have to start actually filing reports and showing growth numbers and everything. I mean, this initial, like, you know, setting of the price and everything is – I don't know. I certainly wouldn't touch it if I was an investor, just because, like, who knows what it is. Like, you might be able to make a short-term.
Mark Zuckerberg said he was going to sell $1 billion of his stock the minute it happened, so he would have $1 billion in cash. I get that you want to be, like, a physical billionaire, but that doesn't necessarily inspire the most amount of confidence. I mean, that's
well, at the same time, though, like, I mean, he'd be stupid not to. I mean, no matter how much you love your own company, it's a terrible idea to have the vast majority of your net worth tied up in one single company, even if it's your own company. I mean,
well, I mean, that's what Bill Gates did. That's what Warren Buffett does.
He's still going to have a ridiculous stake in it. He's probably going to have like a 20% stake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his money in the company is going to be far exceed the $1 billion that's sitting there. But still, I'm just saying it's a very interesting thing to advertise.
Yeah. It's interesting that it's being set so low. I mean, like, it's the market. I mean, it's funny, like, LinkedIn is trading at about $112 per share right now.
Yeah.
And it just, I mean, obviously there's the number of shares versus the cost of the shares and everything, and that drives a lot of it. But it is interesting that, you know, they decided to go with a low number rather than a high number.
Better to go low and have it grow than to have it start high and have it fall.
You think this is going
to... from that point of view, I mean, at the same time, if you're trying to raise money, I mean, keep in mind, the company makes their round – they get their money with first sale. Once it's on the market, they're not really making money off of the value of the stock except...
Yeah, but you're not thinking of it from the perspective of a Facebook principal. So I've been at Facebook for the last 7 years. You know, Facebook is about to make the most amount of billionaires than any IPO, the most amount of millionaires than any IPO has ever made. So... if we IPO big and I'm some upper management guy at Facebook and that and then all my money is tied into the company. First of all, everyone's going to start doing some selling in order to get cash in hand, right? So we're definitely seeing an immediate drop off, but we want to make sure the stock price is low enough so that the average person who is a Facebook user isn't shy about buying a couple. Right.
Yeah.
And that'll help the lift on the side of the stock. If you went Google and said, okay, all my stocks are going to start at like $400, then I think on some level you close the pool of you know what's out there of who's going to be able to pick it up. Institutional investors, yes. But again, Google is a bit less abstract in what it does online than Facebook is. So I think that with 900 million users, let's say they have 150 million users in America, you know, $35 stock. Not a hard thing for the average Joe to pick up if they don't know anything. It's also something that because all these millionaires are going to do a lot of selling off, you don't – in order to get like their money in hand or some of their money in hand, you don't want it dropping from like $150 down to like, you know, $75 in the first couple hours when everyone's just trying to get their money or whatever. So it's okay if a small stock drops. somewhat. It's bad if a big priced stock.
You think it's going to change the experience for the average user when Facebook starts to, once they become a public company and they have to basically chase a revenue stream?
I think it'll become. I think that they'll have a while. They'll have some cushion. They can always pull off what Google did, which is to say, I'm going to like buy back some stock, whatever. But I think they'll have some cushion. Mark Zuckerberg is not notorious, but he's well known for remaining in charge of his company. So I think even though they'll be chasing bottom line revenue stuff, all the initial investors are going to get paid this first time, and Mark Zuckerberg's going to retain a lot of power. An enormous amount of power. So I feel like he's not going to be too tied to the whim of the short-term investor as much as he's going to be being able to have people follow his vision of a long-term gain on the company. And I think that's going to come from surprising things. We've already been surprised with Instagram. You know, Facebook might look into something as crazy as offline, a purchase of an offline company in order to get more data and make that social graph more complete, because right now they only have his online behavior, that kind of thing. So once they have that, you know, and using like magnetic content to drive like purchases and focus on like a cost per action model, you know, I think they'll be doing revenue in a big, big way.
But let's move on to our next topic here. Discovery Communications, a parent of the Discovery Channel, has purchased Revision 3, the web video startup that makes and distributes its own shows like Techzilla and Epic Mealtime. Discovery isn't disclosing a purchase price, but multiple sources familiar with the transaction say that they'll pay around $30 million for the startup. The company ended up raising about $10 million during its six-year lifespan, with the last chunk coming from a group of investors that included Mark Cuban. All Revision 3's 50 employees are supposed to stay on, and there's a chance they could end up pulling down some sizable earnouts, but they probably won't, because that's the nature of earnouts. So Revision 3, this was the video startup that was co-founded by Kevin Rose of Digg.com.
I think it's funny. I'm surprised. Well, I'm glad Kevin Rose made his money, because Digg is, you know, Digg. But I'm surprised that it was Discovery that bought them. Yeah, obviously, you know, these guys need to break into more online stuff. But is it just me, or if Netflix had spent the $30 million on them, I feel like that would have been pretty helpful, because a lot of the people who are on Netflix are the kinds of people who like Revision 3's kind of content. I mean, it is Discovery-type content too, but I'm thinking just that demographic and just the cost. I mean, Netflix paid 100-something million bucks to get Mad Men, $30 million to get a suite of TV shows that it could like build out. I feel like that's a thing too. So,
but you know what? I think Discovery is really, along with many other different networks, are really exploring the whole set-top box, multiple outlet thing, where they're not just relying on their cable channel, that they're really getting into all of the spaces where people consume content outside of big media, and I think that this, something like this, really like rounds out their portfolio.
I don't.
I agree, and they know that they're surprisingly popular with the younger demographic, and trying to figure out ways of taking, you know, that data. And that's, I mean, face it, I mean, they have a fairly geeky audience. I think Revision 3 is a relatively geeky audience, and Discovery Channel is a relatively geeky audience. I think it makes sense to at least explore it. And I mean, this is not, I don't know, I don't know specific numbers in the TV industry, but it doesn't seem like a ridiculous amount to pay for like a media, you know, property that's been around for a while and people watch. And
yeah, it's not an expensive price for, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's an expensive price for what it is. $30 million seems like a little surprised. I'm surprised that he'd want to sell for $30 million, but who knows how the company was doing before.
I think Kevin and company are all like you. Last week we talked about Digg, about the potential Wall Street Journal buying their team basically and leaving the company. So I think Kevin and company are kind of all bailing out of their first generation enterprises and moving on. I don't know what Kevin's doing now since, he's at Google now. He's working for Google. Yeah. So yeah, he's, he's made his fortunes. Okay, let's move on here. This is one of my favorite stories this week. We may see the beginnings of a lesson as to why it's not always the best idea to buy your competition outright. Mobile giant Zynga's game development philosophy has always been, if you can beat them, buy them. If you can't beat them, buy them. Followed by the less welcome, if you can't buy them, clone them. In short, for nearly every game that hits number one in the mobile charts, Zynga will try and buy that company. If they can't, they'll make a similar version of the game themselves. Most recently, Draw Something developer OMG Pop agreed to a Zynga takeover for the cool sum of $200 million. Draw Something was exploding in popularity, and the purchase seemed like a good bet. But now the move might seem equivalent to a company buying huge amounts of stocks in Pogs or members-only jackets without realizing that some things that are popular are merely fads. When you buy a company based on one specific success rather than a string of proven titles, you're setting yourself up for a potential disaster. A new report shows that in the last month, Draw Something has lost nearly 5 million daily active users, bringing the total down to 10 million from 15 million when Zynga first made the purchase. Zynga's problem is that they didn't bother to make sure Draw Something had staying power, something you'd think would be required to shell out $200 million for a company.
Yep.
I don't know. I sort of wondered, like, how long is this actually going to be around? Like, yeah. I found myself not using a huge amount of it even back when, you know, like before they bought it. I mean, you know, Draw Something is a very cool game and everything.
Yeah.
It was, you know, obviously extremely smart of them to sell. I can't really say that there was anything wrong with them. It just, Zynga seemed to sort of jump on it a little bit quickly.
Yeah.
I don't know. There were some people who were trying to say that it was because Zynga had bought it. I think that's kind of stupid. Like, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, people, I think most people didn't even know that Zynga had bought it.
Thing is, it's already, and like, the thing is, they enhanced it once they bought it. Like, the first thing that happened was you got comments in there, which they're not the most amazing comments, like the comment structure with the blue pop up or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's still like a benefit. And I feel like, to Andy's point, the diligence may have been a little off. The idea of, like, you know, clone or buy or clone, that's definitely a little weird. But at the same time, Zynga's relatively desperate. Didn't they lose 99% of profits year over year between last year and this year?
I think so, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so 90% of profits, not 99. So I think they're looking for something that's big and catch on. Draw Something is uniquely original. It's a game that you're not playing against anybody with. Playing with people, it's completely cooperative, which is new in a lot of is one of social games. The only problem for me with the game is that it takes a lot of time, and
yeah,
time is something that you have, you know.
Yeah, I agree. That's been my biggest issue with it. It's really cool game, but, like, you know, I see somebody is, you know, giving me a thing to play, and I'm like, oh gosh, I don't have time. I got to do something now. You know, like, it's not a casual thing. That's honestly my biggest problem with Zynga's games across the board. Like, I mean. Even I played Farmville for a little bit when it first came out, and, like, it wasn't that bad. It was kind of fun, but, like, it just took so much freaking time. I got sick of it. Like, I don't know. And I mean, I guess that's the business
that's the
they're
problem
trying
with
to be
fad,
in.
Right?
I mean, maybe what they're hoping, and this has got to be what they're thinking at this point, is that they can, change it so that it's something that can make it long term, you know, bring out some monetization options so that they don't have to have a huge user base in order to keep it going. Like, let's face it, Zynga's model is not necessarily get tons and tons and tons and tons of people to use their game and make a little bit of money off all of them. Zynga's model is get tons of people into your game until you find the people who are super addicted to it and make tons of money off of them.
Yep.
Like, the average Zynga user might pay like $2, but, you know, I've heard that, like, what really happens is, like, 1% of Zynga users will pay thousands of dollars and everyone else pays nothing. And, yeah, I don't know. Like, that's – I don't know. Maybe we will, but that's their business model. So they didn't pay for all the users. They paid for the users who were still paying.
So one of the things that Zynga's doing to try and recoup their losses there on Draw Something is that they're working with they're working with brands to incorporate the brand names into the Draw Something words, like Coca-Cola or Doritos. I don't know.
That's... Yeah, I noticed that. I think that's an interesting monetization policy. Yeah. I guess you can make an impression. You can pay. You can basically say, okay, for every time I show it to the people, you got to pay me a little bit. Every time they choose it to draw it, you got to pay me something more. Every time someone draws it successfully and, like, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. got to pay me a little bit more. That kind of – that's how I would try to structure that. I think it does – I think it's an interesting way to go. But I also think that they're really focused on diversification and yeah. OMG Pop. The thinkers that put together that game
mm-hmm.
might have something up their sleeves – Or just a wellspring up their sleeves that allows Zynga to, you know, kind of move away from the cloning. You know what I mean?
That's my point, because that's right. It wasn't – they didn't just purchase the company. They bought the people. It was one of those – what do they call them?
Talent acquisitions.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a name for it, though. I know you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah. It's like something
– Acquisitions or acquihires.
Acquihire. That's right. It was an acquire, hire. A-C-Q-H-I-R-E.
We need to come up with a better name for that. I cannot pronounce that.
I like talent acquisition. Straightforward to the point.
But yeah, no. Maybe OMG Pop has some talent up their sleeves that can actually help the company as a whole. Who knows? I mean, frankly, I don't care, to be honest.
I bet your daughter does, though.
She loves Draw Something. Loves it. It's her favorite game, I think, next to Jetpack...
Joyride.
Joyride. Jetpack Joyride. Yeah. Yes.
Oh,
I told Chris about that game. He got addicted.
I'm so freaking addicted. Like, if our startup does not get off the ground, I will blame Jetpack Joyride. Like, more than anything else, it would be Jetpack Joyride. You know, honestly, yeah. let's face it. Like, while we're talking about Zynga, uh-huh. like, can I just say, I think part of the reason why they're failing, I mean, I think they're just reaching the limits of, like, what they can do, right? I mean, like, you know, like, I don't know anyone around here who wants to work for Zynga.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, like, it's everything that people hear about it is not something that makes it sound like a place you want to work. It doesn't make it, you know, and they got to be sustainable. And if you can't, like, sustain, I don't know. I don't know if you can. Like, I really honestly think, like, we're going to look back on this decade and be like, oh, man, do you remember when everyone played Farmville? Oh, yeah, gosh. Do you remember back in the 90s and everyone played Pogs? Oh, yeah. You know, like, I just don't see social gaming as something that is going to become, like, a fixture of modern society in the way
that
it is.
What about Second Life? Is Second Life – I mean, I don't – how big does Second Life remain? I remember there was a time
– Play Second Life?
That's a good question.
Exactly. So I'm thinking that, like, part of this is that, you know, it's a fad because – it's really engrossing. It's a new paradigm. You jump into it and you're all excited about it. But then it takes up time that you don't necessarily have. Like, the whole thing with Facebook and everything is that, you know, how much productivity does it suck up? These games really suck it up. Then, you know, there's only – I mean, they've got to continue to develop the game, but the paradigms are relatively simple. So how much longer can you live as, like, some random person in some random world in the case of Second Life, or, you know, drawing back and forth? That is a little exciting because the content is made by your peer. And it's all about how well do you know them and things like that. They can continue to add there. But a lot of the stuff I've seen with Farmville and everything, I don't really get what I'm getting out of it. Not that I get a whole bunch out of Portal besides some, you know, puzzle solving. But I get exhilarated when I play Portal. I don't get exhilarated when I play these games. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I think Devinger's like kind of hates social games, because they're not totally engrossing, and because you can do them, so it's so easy to slide into them. When I want to play Portal, I gotta turn my TV to a different thing. I've gotta turn on my PlayStation. I've gotta pull out the controller, and I've gotta make a whole bunch of deliberate decisions to get into that game. Once I'm in it, I'm in it for hours. With the social stuff, you kind of slide in, you slide out, and then one day you're like, I'm not really that committed, and you walk away.
Well, it becomes much more like on a total, like a total life engrossing, right? I mean, like, you're constantly thinking about it in the back of your mind and everything. I think it's part of what sort of draws people into it.
But, you know, I think a lot of people grow out of it. Like, a lot of – I would like to see the demographics of the individuals who are playing all these games on Facebook. And if you're, like, 14 and you're thinking about it all the time, like your Tamagotchi, whatever happened to those, you know? Tamagotchis, Beanie Babies, they hit this crazy hardcore demographic. and then – you kind of – your perspective changes because you're changing. And so they've got to work on trying to get that demographic again, but it's sort of ephemeral because you're trying to hit that particular segment, and that segment will never exist again. because their generation is kind of gone or whatever. So I don't know. I guess I'm not saying I know the answer or anything. I just think it's I like the way you're thinking about it. I guess I haven't been able to understand how it remains engrossing for the average user.
Let's move on here before I get too caught up in that. When Randall Stephenson, AT&T's chief executive, spoke about the state of the wireless industry at a conference this week, he shared some surprisingly frank comments about the iPhone. He said, "My only regret was how we introduced pricing in the beginning, because how did we introduce pricing? $30 and you get all you can eat." He said at the onstage interview at the Milken Institute's global conference on Wednesday, "And it's a variable cost model. Every additional megabyte you use in this network, I have to invest capital." But that's not the end of AT&T's concerns. He said he's worried about services that could replace the company's own offerings. For example, free internet-based messaging services like Apple's iMessage are eating into the company's revenue from text messages. "You lie awake at night worrying about what is that which will disrupt your business model," he said. "Apple iMessage is a classic example. If you're using iMessage, you're not using one of our messaging services, right? That's disruptive to our messaging revenue stream." First of all, I'm not sure that
Oh, my God. Okay, go on.
First of all, I'm not sure. Well, I have 2 points here. And the first point is that, he claims to have regret for introducing this pricing structure in the beginning, but the point is that no one that was the enticement deal that got people to sign on. So you can't have regret for introducing that pricing structure and at the same time not regret all of the consumers that you got to buy into your service because of that. And secondly,
it's hindsight heavily.
Yeah. And secondly, yeah. I'm not entirely sure I buy that every additional megabyte you use in the network, he has to invest capital.
I buy that part. That's the one part I do buy. It's confusing. It's not confusing, but it's definitely concerning to me that as iPhone usage grows, all smartphone usage grows, every megabyte that they're buying, they have to think about, okay, how many, like, they have to judge every megabyte being used. They have to judge. If they extrapolate how many more are going to be used as we pick up more subscribers, I've got to build more network for that. That was the big problem when the iPhone first showed up and AT&T's networks ground to a halt. The reason why it's usable today is because they've been spending all this money on infrastructure to grow it. Yeah. They paid Starbucks for the AT&T Wi-Fi thing. Right. I'm sure that helps like, you know, a good 10-15%. But for the most part, and they had the Femtocell thing or whatever. For the most part, they've been having to build their 3G network and run, just try to keep ahead of Verizon and its claims about 3G coverage, even though Verizon's 3G is a very different animal. And on top of that, they had to build this 4G network. So where do you put the money, the 4G or the 3G? You got to think of that. So that's a big thing. For me, I think that really upsets me, though, is the iMessage thing, because it's clear that the cost of a text message to the carrier is nothing near like the cost of the text messages to the user. The margins are incredible on a text message.
Right. Yes.
It's amazing they were able to get away with that as long as they did. And like,
it's highway. Yeah.
It's criminal. It's criminal. It's just like printer ink, in my opinion.
Yeah. And honestly, if you're a company, like, you need to understand like which things you're doing that are business opportunities that are like long-term investments and which are business opportunities that are a short-term gain that you can get. And like sometimes in business, you have to take a short
Go ahead. And sometimes in business, you have to take a short term.
Yeah, when you're it's not a bad thing necessarily to take those short term opportunities if they come to you, right? I mean, people really wanted texting when it first came out, and obviously they were willing to pay those high rates. But you can't like sit around and complain when what was clearly a short term opportunity gets disrupted in the way that it logically was going to be. Like, what do they think, people were just going to like start paying like hundreds of dollars a month to like continue texting? Like, it just seems
But I'm saying BlackBerry has been doing this for a long time. Yeah, the iPhone has outgrown BlackBerry, and like it's leaps and bounds more, whatever. But part of it's just also that, you know, yes, your MMS and SMS services were exorbitant, and you have to realize that like it wasn't the oil problem. Like, when a country gets oil, they don't think about the future. They just spend, you know. Like, I don't know, I guess it just seems really, really weird and strange that the iOS text messaging thing was brought up next to the megabyte thing, unless all the money for growing the network came out of text messaging. I guess it's important for us to see a breakdown of between minutes and data and SMS and other services they provide. What was the line share? What was the whatever? I think iMessage is one of the best and worst parts of iOS 5. It's the best in terms of it's really quick and it has tracking and it has all these other things. It's the worst in terms of when the data network is down, it's really impossible to use it. Whereas text messaging only needed one bar in order to send that hit to the tower, and you're using phone kind of stuff. That said, it's really hard for me to believe that he's upset that people have found a more efficient way. When BlackBerry was around, when Kik showed up, when a bevy of services have been in this space for just so long. Let's count this up. You could use Trillion. You could use Kik. You can use Facebook Messenger, IM Plus. There's just chat on. GroupMe, all these things were taking over this particular space for so long that they clearly saw it coming, and they should have thought about a way to, I don't know, do a rev share with Apple or something, some business focused strategy to not leave them feeling in the cold. It's a little irresponsible, but then again, it's a 100-plus-year-old company, so they just haven't been thinking in modern terms, perhaps.
Yeah, it's funny that, I don't know, it's weird that they. I think that like the phone industry has to be like one of the few industries out there that like complains about its users. Like, think about it. Like, almost every other company that exists would be like, "Oh my gosh, we have so many users, we can hardly beat demand. This is awesome." You know, like, we're not figure out how to solve this, right? You know, but like the phone industry is like, "Oh my gosh, we've got so many users. What are we going to do?" Complain. Like, it just, you know, they got to start thinking of this. This is a long term investment, and honestly, like, I think people see them as, you know, providers of data services, and that's what they should be focusing on. And honestly, these investments they're making to their network are extremely important for that. I know that they want to be like consumer facing, you know, cool, hip companies, but I'm just not sure if that's what they need to be. I'm not even sure if that's necessarily where the businesses are. I mean, if they could figure out ways to, you know, sell to, you know, other companies, you know, as a marketplace, you know, then they could let the other companies take all the risk and support of handling the customers and, you know, run these networks awesomely. I think there's a model for that, but I don't know.
It's just kind of like, I don't know, it's disappointing to see that. I mean, first of all, I do think that if you look at like the way Europe had been doing data, the idea of unlimited was it's anathema to them on some level, right? Like, you pay for your phone outright. It's not subsidized. You don't have unlimited data. You don't have unlimited text messaging. You pay for things, and things cost more money. If the idea was to get them hooked on discounts and then ratchet it up, then their PR people weren't thinking about making sure that message worked. So I don't know. It's weird. And then now they do these funny things where, you know, it's unlimited, but tethering costs more. And I know that the minute there's a 4G LTE iPhone, all of our current unlimited contracts are going to be over. And they're going to be like, well, just like how when the Edge iPhone, the 2G iPhone was finished and they had a 3G iPhone, they had the new 3G plan, which costs, you know, X amount of more dollars, you know, a third more money for the same thing, basically, on the new network. And I have a feeling that the same thing's going to happen again when we all move over to 4G. You know, so it's difficult. I get it. I get that they have... They're trying not to be a commodity service, but it just shows kind of a lack of foresight, you know. Also their competition. It's the only company. I guess it's like, yeah, you know, go back to Big Oil. One of the few things where I feel like I feel less like a customer and more like a perpetual enemy. Like, I'm their enemy. I feel like as a person who wants, you know, data and everything like that, and I pay for my 3G iPad separately than I pay for my iPhone. I feel like they're constantly trying to find ways to deny me. It's like my FSA at work. Like, they're trying to find ways to deny me the services I'm paying for. So I get like emotionally like angry at these companies.
And in this case, I think that's why like any company who offers all you can eat, like Sprint in this particular case, has the advantage, because that is the selling point. That's what you're. That's what you're buying, you know, and if you can continue to guarantee that, then more power to you. Let's move on here. a jury has found that Google infringed Oracle's Java copyrights in Android, but could not decide unanimously if the infringement was protected by fair use. The jury's verdict, delivered Monday after a week of deliberation, is a partial victory for Oracle in its lawsuit against Google, but Oracle will have to wait longer, possibly for a retrial, to see whether Google will escape liability with its claim of fair use, as well as the outstanding issue of fair use. Judge William Alsop, who is hearing the case, must decide whether Oracle's Java APIs can be copyrighted at all under U.S. law. Historically, APIs have not been considered copyrightable, but Oracle argues that the, quote, structure, sequence, and organization of the 166 API packages in Java are sufficiently complex to merit protection. Now, I have to admit that this particular issue seemed fairly esoteric to me, except for the fact about APIs being copyrightable, which seemed to have a larger potential impact for the tech industry at all. What did you guys think about this?
So my interpretation of, or my understanding of this, was that the ruling this week was that the jury was instructed to assume, for the purposes of deliberation, that the APIs are copyrightable. So if the APIs are copyrightable, did Google? So the ruling ends up being that if APIs are something that can be copyrighted, then Google infringed upon that. But as I understand, there were like seven or eight other allegations with this that were shot down too. And the judge still has to rule on whether or not APIs are copyrightable at all, and that's not going to be a jury thing.
It's not going to be an easy thing either, because that's a wide implication across the entire web. Think about every app on every mobile phone. And whether or not they need license. And every company that has an API is going to have to issue a license, even if it's free, because of the idea that could possibly be copyrighted. Now, did Google go out and obviously, like, you know, do Java on their own? And did it result in I think some of the stuff that Oracle said was they basically made Java not work cross-platform anymore. The idea of Java is to be write once, run anywhere, but because they did it their own way to work on their telephones, it doesn't do that any longer, and that's like the big hurt to Java. And I think
because Java worked everywhere before and never had to debug.
So that's the claim.
Definitely that's never worked.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of controversy here. I mean, this is this situation with the jury. It's just as Chris described it. It's really if Java's APIs are copyrightable because they're so complex. But I think that's sort of like saying we're going to attack these guys for the WMDs, but really we're going to free them because they have a despot, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
I should explain my sarcasm there. There's a joke about Java that goes back almost as old as the language itself. So their marketing campaign was write once, run everywhere. And in reality, the experience that most Java developers, and I programmed in Java for a while, was run or write once, debug everywhere, because you had something that worked like 80 to 95% of the way on all platforms, and then every single platform had some weird thing that you had to explore. And yeah, so it's just funny to hear Oracle being like, oh, we're supposed to run everywhere, when in reality the experience that everyone had was debugging and trying to get it to work something like everywhere.
They bought this thing and they were like, okay, we can spend all this money on Sun, we got to make some money back. Yeah. We'll get Google to pay for it.
Yeah.
It's kind of how I feel about the whole thing, but you know.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I mean, Sun was stupid. I mean, Sun basically sat on it and didn't do. Innovate. Yeah, they didn't innovate. I mean, well, they did, but they didn't innovate from a business point of view. I mean, like, the JVM under Sun is one of the best virtual machines out there, and there's a whole slew of other languages that use the JVM, the Java's runtime environment, because it's so good. But Java, the language, is. I mean, it's primarily valuable because of the libraries that have been built up around it and the environment itself. But I don't know, the language itself is not my favorite thing to work with.
It leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah. Let's move on here. Google just flipped the switch for Hangouts on Air, allowing almost everyone to stream their Google Plus Hangouts live video chat sessions to an unlimited number of viewers. The company had previously allowed a select number of pre-approved publishers to stream Hangouts, and the feature has been used by pop stars, TV personalities, and even President Obama. Now, I tried to... I've been working... before we started the show, I've kind of been setting up the foundation for doing the drill down via Hangouts on Air. I mean, there are a couple of provisos, of course. One is that everyone would have to agree to be on camera, which I'm not sure everyone wants to be. It's up to you guys entirely. And the other thing is... I think that's basically it. Because, the other thing is that the codec is a little weak, comparatively. The video quality is a little soft and blocky. And I don't know if that's a bandwidth issue or what, but I've seen notice that that's one of the differences between Google Hangouts and Ustream right now. But the good thing is that the two pluses that I would say for this is it's embeddable, so it can be embedded in a post just like we embed the Ustream live show here on Geeks of Doom. And the other plus is that once it's done, it immediately gets saved to a YouTube video file so that you can do whatever you want to do with that YouTube file.
That is smart. That is honestly the big feature, I think, of this and might be something that can finally make Google somewhat Google Plus, you know, something people actually work on. Honestly, this thing has boggled me since the beginning of Google Plus is just how little it seemed to be connected with YouTube, which honestly, like I remember saying this several times before Google Plus rolled out, like Google's social network is YouTube. Like it's this massive, massive network of people who watch tons and tons and tons of videos. Granted, it's not terribly social. It's social in the way that Flickr was social. But like it just this is awesome. Like this is what they need to be doing to actually draw people into it.
Yeah.
I can't promise that I'll be using it, but the other people who want to use Google products.
Well, they've done some more stuff to it to draw people into it too, right? Like today.
I'm looking at our chat room, and Dave in our chat room says that Conan O'Brien did a live hangout with a bunch of Google Plusers for about an hour last night. So they're doing some, you know, definitely doing some promotion stuff or encouraging celebrities to use the service.
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to, Dwayne?
I was thinking about Conan. I was thinking about Obama's on, but I was also thinking about, you know, just the rollout, today's rollout, and what they're doing to, you know, make it an immersive experience.
Yeah.
In addition to the Hangouts, the interface changes.
Oh yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's looking good. It's looking good. Looking change is good. So, in general, I like that.
Yeah, it'll be cool to see what comes out of this.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys have seen the new UI for Google Plus, but it's very smooth. It's very it's less choppy. It's less cartoony, and it's more magazine like.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've been in it, and I gotta say, especially because like. Dave Seligman, he posts a lot to Google Plus, and I read all of his posts. Not all of them, but all the ones that you know I see. And it's easier to follow him. It's literally easier to follow him now than it was yesterday before the new situation came out. So if you've got an iPhone, update Google Plus now and
I guess enjoy the ride. Try out the iPhone version of Google Plus. I have not used it.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's
I don't know what I think about Google's Plus's web interface. I've tried it a few times. I can't put my finger on what it is I don't like about it. Every time I go on there, I just get confused with what I'm doing.
It's confusing. I hope that they change it, and I'm glad that they have someone focusing on the whole mobile aspect of it. It's just very, it's fresh on the iPhone, and whatever happened to developers writing for Android first?
Was that ever the case?
Eric Schmidt said developers are going to start writing for, you know, it was like either Eric Schmidt or the guy whose name starts with R, who's kind of in charge of Android. And they were like, developers are going to be writing for Android first. And I feel like the Google developers did not get the memo when they released this update.
Did you have an Android phone and they've not released it for there too?
No, it's just not out there yet. And I thought, you know, obviously, like, I'm used to, as an iPhone user, when like navigation came out, things like that, I'm used to not having that first. I'm used to waiting. But in this case, we got this update first and it looks so much better than what's on the Android phones currently.
So I've asked this to a number of the mobile startups that I've met around the valley, is like, why do so many, you know, startups go with iOS first, especially when there at this point is a majority of people on the Android platform?
Because the App Store, I would guess the App Store is larger. There's more variety there, I would guess.
Well, I mean, but my question is, why is the App Store so much more variety on iOS? Like, why do the creative types go for that? And it seems like it comes down to the fact that Apple has come up with an extremely consistent API experience across all of their phones. Like, despite the fact that they have two different form factors and three or four different, you know, phones that are on the market right now, you can be pretty sure that something that runs on a 4S, as long as it doesn't require, you know, a super high-end processor, will still run on a 3GS. Like, it's, you're pretty much hitting one platform. Whereas Android, like, despite the fact that it's Java, run once, you know, write once, run everywhere, in practicality and reality is not that way, and you end up spending the vast majority of your time supporting and chasing down obscure bugs that come up through, like, you know, 2% of your users, but who can make or break you in the App Store with their reviews. And if you're trying to build something and iterate quickly, it's so far more efficient to just pick one platform with a consistent thing to aim for. And then once you have your, you know, several million users and some, you know, venture funding, and go around and try to build an Android version. But I wonder if Google's hitting the same problem, that, like, you know, like, oh gosh, you know, it's our own platform, but we got to write it so that it'll work on every single version out there.
Right.
I don't know.
Okay, let's move on here to our final headline story before we get into our major topics. On Monday, the Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles approved Google's license application to test autonomous vehicles on the state's roads. The state has approved such laws back in February and now begun issuing licenses based on those regulations. The Nevada DMV has approved corresponding license plates to go with it, complete with a red background and infinity symbol. So, driverless vehicles in Vegas. That's basically what this story is about.
A city that could probably use them more than other cities. I've never actually been to Vegas, but I'm sure there are lots of people who are not able to drive.
I'd like to see DUIs go away forever, and if it means the robots have to control our cars, then it should be a nice switch you can flip on or off.
You know, you don't even have to be drunk to be a terrible driver, is my experience.
True. I just feel like the DUI thing, I mean, like, you're in the area I live in, and they'll be like, oh, there's a club and they're all just dancing and it's out on highway, whatever. And you're like, oh, that's a recipe for disaster. So it'd be nice to be able to flip it on and flip it off. I remember back in the day in Florida, there were people getting killed because their license plates like clearly showed that the cars were rentals. So people would rob the tourists because why not? And they would get robbed and get killed and stuff. Mm-hmm. I can't wait till these cars look like an everyday car. They look like a normal Honda or a normal Prius, right, without all the stuff on top of them. Yeah. And we don't need special license plates to differentiate them. Like, it's just, you know, a package you buy in mm-hmm. your vehicle, that kind of thing. I can see Google making a significant ton of money licensing this to the car industry. And that's exciting to me because I like the idea that Google is diversified. And this solves a problem. This solves a real big problem. This is an amazing, amazing product.
Yep. It's going to be – I'm going to say it's going to be 5-10 years and we'll be living in that future.
Yeah, I mean, like, think about iRobot, think about Minority Report.
That's exactly
what I was thinking. Always Minority Report.
Yep. Yeah, well, Minority Report, I like the one in iRobot a little better, the idea that, like, your car just meets you and then it takes you and, you know, and, like, you still have the choice to drive it if you want, you know, that kind of thing. I dig that.
All right, let us take a little break here. Before we do, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is audible.com. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I'd like to recommend this week is a children's book. It's called I Am a Pole and So Can You by Stephen Colbert. It's narrated by Tom Hanks and Stephen Colbert. And I have no idea what this book is about, but it was only $1.46 on audible.com, so I bought it.
Sounds worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I bought it, and it's the publisher's summary says it's the story of a pole searching for his purpose in life. And Stephen Colbert says, the perfect gift to give to a child or grandchild for their high school or college graduation, also Father's Day, also other times. So
that sounds excellent. You know, just hearing Stephen Colbert talk is hilarious. So it would be pretty
pretty good. There's a quote here from Maurice Sendak about the book, the late Maurice Sendak, I might add. He said, the sad thing is, I like it. So any sort of like backhanded compliment, if it can be called that at all, then there you go.
The poor book probably put him in his grave. Oh, man.
So let's take a little listen to a clip from I'm a Pole, So Can You by Stephen Colbert, narrated by Tom Hanks and Stephen Colbert. And here we go.
Hachette Audio presents I Am a Pole and So Can You, written by Stephen Colbert. That's me. And read for you by Tom Hanks. That's you, Tom.
Thank you. I am a
dedicated to poles everywhere. Keep dreaming. Excuse me, I was doing the, let me get the dedication again.
Oh, sorry,
You jumped on my dedication.
I'm sorry, sorry.
No problem.
Thought you were done.
Nope.
Thought you were done.
Is this your first audiobook?
This is, actually.
It really? Yeah, it is?
Big
okay.
honor.
Well, welcome to the game, as we call it.
Listen, anything for a couple $100. Here I am.
So that was a little clip from I'm a Pole and So Can You, a children's book by Stephen Colbert, narrated by Tom Hanks and Stephen Colbert. It's unabridged at a running time of 8 minutes. So there you go. And it's only $1.46. But you can get that book as well as any of Audible's 100,000 plus titles for free. And all you need to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook plus a trial to give you a chance to check out their service. So we're going to take a little break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about CS Lie or Resume Gate or whatever you call it, the biggest scandal this week involving Yahoo's CEO. So
as if Yahoo didn't have enough trouble.
Yeah, really. Oh, man, insult to injury. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Christopher Bernor. And Yahoo's new CEO, Scott Thompson, came under fire this week for telling the SEC and Yahoo's board that he had a computer science degree from Stonehill College when he does not have one. Yahoo's persistent thorn, activist shareholder Dan Loeb of Third Point, poison-penned a letter to the board of the Silicon Valley Internet Company demanding that Yahoo fire its new CEO, Scott Thompson, as well as director Patty Hart, over bizarre inaccuracies related to their academic achievements. He said permitting Mr. Thompson and Ms. Hart to stay with the company after apparently violating the code of ethics sends a message to all Yahoo employees that a different set of rules applies at the top. Yahoo must terminate Mr. Thompson for cause immediately given his demonstrable unsuitability to remain chief executive officer and director of Yahoo and accept the resignation of Ms. Hart for similar reasons. In a nutshell, Thompson does not have a computer science degree, as he has maintained he did in public bios for almost a decade, a falsehood that mysteriously seeped into documents Yahoo filed with the SEC.
Actually, I was just checking because I heard a tweet about this earlier, but It looks like Patty Hart is actually going to resign over this.
Yes, she was the fall girl, as it were.
Well, one of them. Hopefully, there will be a fall guy too.
It's a scapegoat. Yeah, it's a scapegoat.
Well, that's what I want to ask you a question now. Now, given everything that Scott Thompson has done for the company, do the ends justify the means?
The company needs integrity. This is not an integrity thing. The company needs integrity. That's the company's biggest problem. Not biggest problem, but one of the biggest problems. It has no integrity. They are doing, they're suing Facebook. They're getting rid of their technology. They don't have the whole public opinion thing isn't going to help.
Yeah.
If the guy running it is a scam artist.
The thing is, it's just like such a fundamental violation. I mean, it doesn't really matter if he was a great CEO or a terrible CEO. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like finding out that Larry or Sergey didn't actually go to Stanford. I mean, like you just simply have to trust on some level that the person you're dealing with is trustworthy, and especially the board has to. And you know, like if he's going to lie about something that significant, it doesn't really matter if he's right or not, or if he's good or not for the company. You know, it's just one of those things you can't.
It's clearly not
step
good for
away.
The company. Like even like no. If anything, he needs to like they need to. I don't know. It's just like the idea is that like it's Chris is right. It's a fundamental lack of honesty, which means it's a fundamental lack of respect for the user and for anyone else with a CS degree, right? All their time in their youth, you know, between ages 18 and 22, maybe they go back to school for it or whatever. They have CS degrees and this guy doesn't. And he's been able to profit from that. And that's a slap in the face to anyone, any developer who'd want to work for Yahoo.
Well, it's good. Well, I don't know why any developers would want to work for Yahoo, but it's going to be a huge hit on morale. I mean, I will tell you, like, tomorrow in the lunchroom at Yahoo, there are going to be people being like, "Gotcha, I don't have a CS degree either." You know, like it's going to come to a point where like people are just simply not going to respect their CEO. Like I've worked in a larger company, and like you know the CEO is an important sort of figurehead for the company, and that's as important inside as it is outside. And he's going to be the butt of an awful lot of jokes for time to come. And like that's
what's Jerry. Go ahead. That's. Go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
No, that was all I was going to say. I sometimes completely leave ellipses on the end of sentences where I should put periods.
what's Jerry Yang thinking? That's the question.
Hopefully Jerry Yang is just on a yacht somewhere, like recovering from Silicon Valley. I don't know. You know, like Jerry Yang has done a huge amount for the web. I don't know. I wonder if his time is over.
My hope is that he is glad to have gotten out before all of this went down. Although, as much as I know he has some sort of passion for the company that he should have let go a long time ago. You know, he stuck with it for the longest time, and I'm hoping that maybe now this is like the wake up call that he was like, "Phew, I dodged that bullet." Patty Hart was let go. She's resigning. She's already the CEO of another company, International Game Technology, which makes game equipment and systems products. So I think that was kind of one of those collateral damage things. And Thompson issued a memo recently that said, as I told you on Friday, the board is reviewing the issue and will provide whatever they need from me. In the meantime, I want you to know how deeply I regret how this issue has affected the company and all of you. We've been working very hard to move the company forward, and this has had the opposite effect. For that, I take full responsibility, and I want to apologize to you. So he apologizes about the disruption, but he did not apologize about the
fact. Actually doing it. Yeah, it's typical, like, non-apology apology. I don't know.
It's none of your business. What are you worried about that for?
I can't say that I'm terribly, like, impressed with him, like, as it's come. I mean, like, I know that he's doing hard decisions that need to be done, and that certainly, you know, is going to be a difficult process. I mean, look at Jobs when he came into Apple at the beginning of the 2000s. Like, that was a rough time for Apple. There were an awful lot of products that people were very excited about that were just killed off as a company, you know, had to, you know, focus on its core strengths and everything. But it seems like an awful lot of what Yahoo has been doing is going after, like, short-term gains at the expense of long-term stability. I mean, like, you know, laying off a huge amount of, you know, their Flickr staff that has been there, you know, for 10 years. I mean, those are the people that know and essentially are Flickr. Like, that's one of their best properties. What do they expect to do with it now? Like, it just, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what they should have been doing, but I just, what I've seen of him, he seems like, not to be blue, but he reminds me sort of like Chris Christie's approach in Jersey, my home state. Like, you know, sort of, we're just going to cut a bunch of things and hopefully it'll work. And not really sort of like focusing on building up the, you know, the company, which, you know, still has good revenues and good traffic numbers and, you know, probably even some good engineers still. But I don't know. Anyway, good luck to them. My message to anyone who works at Yahoo listening is bail out, bail out.
Yeah, it's just a lot of disappointment, and this doesn't help. That's all I got to say about that.
Yeah. So are we done with that whole topic? We can move on to our final words. That was like the shortest hot topic ever.
That's okay. We had a long headlines.
We did.
Long way to get into it. Yeah, no, it's I don't know. Sometimes we spent a lot of time talking about, I think, Yahoo on the Symbiotic podcast. And honestly, I just want them to kind of, like, I don't know. They need to go the way of MySpace or something and just sort of be something that we just don't talk or care about anymore. I mean, you know, obviously they're still in the news and we should talk about them, but it's just sort of like, oh, they're still around. Like, yeah.
So, like, AOL. Remember AOL? AOL is still there. You can still
hear
about
AOL. Past them every day going to work, and I'm just like, how do you have an office building?
Because they have TechCrunch, they have Huffington Post, they have all these things. So they're still there.
Yeah, but they might even – no. I heard
they're
rumors.
They're not the ghost of TechCrunch.
So they're
not
selling
– of Huppo.
Yeah. They're not selling TechCrunch according to their – the rumors were earlier this week that they would be selling – they were looking for buyers for TechCrunch. And then their CEO just, you know, responded with saying that not only are they not selling TechCrunch, but they're doubling down investing in more in TechCrunch. So
yeah, so I mean, like, AOL's still there. Yahoo can possibly get out of the hole they're in. They just have to really focus. They have to, like, hunker down and focus, and that's not what they're doing. But I digress. Let's get away from Yahoo.
Are they worried about all those daily pandos that people can have? I mean, like, I really enjoy my daily pando. Whatever Pando is, but I get one daily, I guess.
All right.
It's built a vibrant company.
Let's take a little break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about a couple of rumors that have been bubbling up in regarding Apple stuff. So take a listen to this and come on back.
She ain't real. She ain't going to be able to love you like I will. She is a stranger. Don't you remember? Sure, she's got it all. But baby, is that really what you want? Blessed up, so you got your love anymore. He's the one I'm leaving you for.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini, and I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Christopher Bernard. And there have been a couple of different Apple rumors bubbling around recently. Apple is reportedly considering responding to the upcoming second-generation Ultrabooks by launching a $799 MacBook Air in the third quarter of 2012, according to sources from an upstream supply chain. Currently, Apple's 11-inch 64-gig MacBook Air is priced at $999, with a 128-gig version priced at $1,199. The 13-inch 128-gig version is at $1,299. The 256-gig, which is the one that I have, frankly, is $1,599. If Apple decides to launch a $799 MacBook Air, the sources believe the strategy will damage Ultrabooks, allowing Apple to continue to press its advantage.
They don't have to drop a $799. They don't have to make a new product. All they have to do is sell the existing product for less money, the same way they've done with iPhones and iPads. And we finally move into the place where the new Apple, when I say new, I mean like the Apple of the 2000s, is a place where people who aren't crazy moneyed can get their hands on a product. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it used to be like you can still get an iPhone for free now. The idea you can get anything from Apple for free, you know, 10 years ago, you're like, you must be crazy. It's Apple. But the idea of an $800 little device, computer that's like a full-fledged computer – that's an Apple. Mm-hmm. That's something that the Mac heads will adore, and anyone who's in the entry level who's looking for a certain programming functionality will be like, yeah, I could do that. It's also going to probably be, you know, it's going to run Windows too, on like aluminum hardware, which people are kind of into as well. So I don't think they have to make a brand new product in order to pull this off, which is why this rumor doesn't seem crazy to me. They just have to make it so that the current product remains supported.
And I think that's almost definitely what I think they're going to. I mean, Apple, I can't remember a time when Apple's come out with a, like, I guess there was the Shuffle and the Nano, but they don't tend to come out with, stripped-down version. Yeah, they tend to just simply take their existing products, like the 3GS, and you know, use them as ways of getting people in. And honestly, Apple's supply chain and their manufacturing like methods at this point are really beginning to chip away at the old idea that Apple products are super expensive. I mean, Apple products are not cheap. You're not going to get a $700, you know, 15-inch laptop, though you can from HP. But you start to compare like what you get that HP has to offer that's comparable to what Apple has to offer, and it's not even like a close comparison. Like you'd have to be spending $2,000 or more to get comparable products from most PC manufacturers. I realized that back when I was looking into getting a netbook when I bought my Asus computer here. I was able to spend $500 to get this computer, but this thing is a glorified netbook that costs as much as an iPad and has never even at its, you know, when it was brand new, been as close to, you know, the experience you can get with an iPad. So like, and also, Apple products are just dropping like rocks when it comes to prices. I mean, it's like you can get, you know, a low-end 13-inch MacBook for under $1,000. And that is nothing like what we, you know, had, I mean, saw 10 years ago.
Used MacBook?
No, like the regular MacBook.
There is no regular MacBook. It starts with a MacBook Air 11 inches at $999.
That's what I meant. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Is a move like this, is it going to make the competition price their entries lower to compete with the Apple, and everyone's going to, you know, basically benefit from this price war amongst the?
I mean, it looks like this is a fight with the Ultrabooks, right? I mean, that's essentially what this has to be. Like they're taking the
the Ultrabooks that are coming out from HP and Asus and everything, and they're saying, oh, well, we got, you know, a whole bunch of old 11-inch ones. Sure, we'll just undercut it, you know, by $200. And it's a Mac, but, you know, it's an Air. So, yeah, I think this is definitely a consequence of the you know, moves that Intel and the main manufacturers are trying to do with their Ultrabooks. And it's a smart one, especially given that this is estimated to come out in Q3 right before the holiday.
Yep.
Right about the time that people are going to be buying computers for going back to school. Like, seriously, that's the best time to do a drop to get people into your product.
So you think this is going to be like one of those things where they announce it during WWDC, where we're expected to see new MacBook Pros? And you know, coming soon, this you know, we're going to drop the price of the old one to whatever. Like, I feel like, I don't know. The timing, I do like the timing, just like how I liked the October release of the iPhone 4S because it did help with Christmas. Like, I think it was a good thing. But I don't know. I was telling Andy, rumors are so painful because it's like, okay, I can think about it and try to make sense of it. But in fact, there's no real data here. iPad HD, iPad 3, iPad whatever. There's no data, you know? So yeah.
Well, I think it's important to remember, like, when it comes to Apple, like, Apple doesn't do things until they're ready, and they will delay it if it's not ready. So, like, it's not like they just, like, have these secret things and they really want to keep it. Like, it's secret partly because, like, they will delay something, you know, if it's not ready to go out on time. So I'm sure they have their aims about when they'd like to do it and everything, but I don't know. The more I've paid attention to Apple, the more I've realized you just, you know, you hope when things happen, you have some vague idea when something is going to be happening, mm-hmm. but there is absolutely no guarantee.
Right.
And that's partly why they're able to, you know, build, you know, awesome products. They don't tell their shareholders, you know, a year down the road, oh, here's this awesome product that is going to be available next year, mm-hmm. that, you know, isn't even out of the draft phase yet. They're like, here's an awesome product that you can buy now or in a month. Right. And the shareholders may not like that, but the consumers do. And ultimately, that makes the shareholders happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the biggest leap of faith of any company that I know of to ask their shareholders to have so much blind faith in them. But I think only Apple can get away with that.
Yeah. Yeah, at this point.
Okay, moving on here. A Cult of Mac has a source who claims to have seen a prototype Apple high definition television set in action, indicating that Apple is readying the long-awaited device for market. According to their source, who is asked to remain strictly anonymous, of course, the Apple TV looks a lot like Apple's current lineup of cinema display monitors. It resembled an Apple monitor, only larger, their source said. The Apple HD TV makes FaceTime calls using a built-in iSight camera. The camera is sophisticated with the facial recognition and the ability to zoom into the user's face and follow them as they walk around the room. This allows users to make video calls from the couch across the room rather than to have to stand smack in front of the TV. In addition, the calls are initiated by Siri, the iPhone 4S's virtual assistant. Apple used Siri to make a FaceTime call, the source said. Unfortunately, Cult of Mac doesn't know any more about other Siri integration or the TV's interface in general or the specs, the pricing, release schedule. They do have some interesting mock-ups on their site, which is worth taking a look at. And maybe we can embed like one of those pictures into the show post. Did you guys see this their post? And what did you think about it if you did see it?
It's certainly an intriguing idea. I would be very – I am expecting Apple to come out with a TV either this fall or next winter. And honestly, I mean, Apple – one thing I think Apple doesn't get enough credit for,
mm-hmm.
Apple has some of the best displays out there on the market. Like, you compare, like, their laptop displays or even their bigger, you know, the cinema displays to, you know, other you know, computer monitors out there, and they're definitely some of the highest end displays you can get out there. I've noticed that, you know, comparing my computer to like my founder's, my boss's computers, you know, they both have Macs and I have this Asus, and like, you know, mine starts to look distorted even about 30 degrees away from straight on. Whereas Apple's, you know, displays are very, very, very high quality. And it would be honestly silly given that they have that technology. it would be kind of silly for them not to go into the TV market at some point, especially given, you know, the rest of their what they do.
Their ecosystem. Yeah, I feel like so this thing talked about how they weren't like some amazing 4K displays. They're still like, you know, 1080p. That made a lot of sense to me because glass is the big problem when it comes to throwing out high quality displays, like getting glass, the right pixel rate, mm-hmm. and all that stuff, and then content too. So I feel like it's not totally off the market if it exists, but just like not enough there to really get excited about. Sounds like it's going to be really, really heavy. If it's designed the same way as their cinema displays,
but
it has this like camera in it. Sounds like it's going to be really, really heavy. As a person who just picked up a TV, I don't want to see this come out for a while. I picked up a TV last Black Friday. I don't need Apple to drop anything that's going to make me, you know, run out and get something. But
well, I think the real killer app for still is going to be the interface, which I don't think anything that has been described here in this post is worthy of what Steve Jobs his last words were, that he had cracked TV. It doesn't feel to me like that's what is being described here, throwing FaceTime and Siri in a television set. I think the real secret is going to be either the interface or the infrastructure, rebuilding the infrastructure, as we've kind of discussed before with making channels available as apps where you could buy, you know, HBO Go separately and have that in your app menu. And
yeah, I don't know. I feel like everyone said that the iPad was just like not – was just, you know, it's a big iPod Touch. 3 years later, everybody wants one. So even if it is just like a flat TV thing, I feel like – I mean, obviously, I think the iOS is a big component. Yes, apps. Yes, content. But I feel like even if it's just a big flat TV, it's going to be shiny and beautiful, and people will do what they can, especially if it only costs like $1,000 or $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to pick it up because it's there to compete with – Sony, with all the other ones. You know, if they get a cinema display, which costs $1,000 already, but they have to make a bigger one, so let's throw it at $2,000, and let's throw an Apple TV in it, it's $2,100. And that's it with the existing margins or whatever. I just feel like it's a – I don't know. It's a rumor. It's murky to say, but I definitely think that there's a lot of money to be made from people being like, I just want the Apple TV. I don't need anything else. And then once the people have the Apple TV, then they can lean heavily on, just like the iPod came out and then the App Store came out. I mean, the iTunes Music Store came out. The iPhone came out, then the App Store came out. I can see the Apple TV coming out and then a modified, and then like a real big push into the media because it's selling like wildfire or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, not exactly the same in terms of correlation, but you guys get what I mean. See what kind of traction you can get and then begin to push the guys like HBO and all the other ones.
Right. Okay, anything else you guys want to talk about before we close off the show for this week?
Nope, I'm good.
Nope, sounds pretty...
All right.
Covered pretty much everything I heard about. It's been kind of a slow week, this is sort of the calm before the storm, because June we have Google I.O., Facebook Connect, Twitter, whatever Twitter's thing is called, WWDC, like... Everyone does their big announcements and everything. So, well, this is sort of the calm period between South by and WWDC.
Oh, boy. I actually can't wait for WWDC. I'm not sure. I mean, they usually don't introduce products at WWDC, right? It's usually just the OS.
No, that's not true. They introduced the first four iPhones at WWDC.
Oh, so you think that this might be where they drop the iPhone 5?
No. Well, first of all, I don't know if it'll be called the iPhone 5 because it's the 6th iPhone. But second of all, I really feel like we just don't know. Like, they're going to do whatever they think is the most applicable right. And I do think that a lot of what we've been hearing about in terms of redesign of Mac hardware, that's totally ripe for WWDC. But at the very least, I think we'll see a preview of iOS 6 and a preview, and we'll see Mountain Lion,
right? You know, right, for sure.
So, but although Mountain Lion is supposed to be
incremental, going like, you know, get more bridging of iOS and OS X. So I think that's the things that are for sure. Mountain Lion and iOS 6. It seems strange to me that they released iOS 6 on an iPhone 5, but who cares?
Yeah.
All right. Let me go around the room here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you on the web when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me at twitter.com/DwayneD, flavors.me/DwayneD, and fairly soon you'll be able to see all my stuff on DwayneD.net. I'm basically just trying to figure out how to do it without having to manage any kind of, you know, thing that I have to update, like WordPress or whatever. So we're working on that puppy. Oh, also gpto.to/DwayneD.
How about yourself, Chris? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the show?
You can find my tweets at CrisBurnor, CHRISBURNOR, and then my blog posts at chrisburnor.com. Pretty much everything I do is linked to off of there, which is mostly GitHub these days, for those who are interested in that. So, yeah.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. That's my Tumblr. I believe, Nets, but it's got also social links on the side, or gplus.to/MrBabyMan. Again, all my social links are there. As far as, or also facebook.com/MrBabyMan and twitter.com/MrBabyMan. Just Google MrBabyMan, you'll find me. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to Geeks of Doom, and we're in the top right hand corner of the page there. Just look for the Drill Down logo and click on it, and that'll take you right to our iTunes subscription page. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Please sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send your story to submissions@thedrilldown.com. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.